The following is a presentation of Morning Drive Media and the Wrestling Viewpoint Network. Welcome back to the Wrestling Viewpoint Network. I'm Ken Napsok, and here we are for a very special edition of the California Classic Wrestling Podcast. In the studio with me, he's been a roving reporter for a while, doing some mini-sodes of the Cali Classic Wrestling Podcast on the road at Wrestling Cares and various places around Southern California. But in the Wrestling Viewpoint Lounge right now is Dan Farron.
In the lounge. That's something new. I didn't know we were in the lounge.
This is the lounge now, man. It's the flair for the gold set.
There we go. So yeah, it's good to be back. It's good to be back doing the podcast a little longer.
Yeah, your rabid fan base, man. You have how many people in the California Classic Wrestling group?
We have 615
now?
as of this show.
Okay,
and I truthfully am very, very selective to the point where I do check, because you know every day you get four or five new people that want to join the group, and generally when I get half naked pictures of women from France, mm-hmm. who were just born like 20 years ago, I usually consider them not to be hardcore California wrestling fans.
Are you sure? Do you ask them some questions?
I send them a little test, okay. like a football test, to go over that. But no, I do feel very strongly about keeping, you know, I want the group to be made up of fans, mm-hmm. Who were around during that time, people who want to learn.
Yeah.
About that time, and actually some professionals who we have several people who wrestled at the Olympic at one time or another.
Yeah,
to be part of that, and so whenever I get a request, I don't just okay it. I go and take a look at it.
I vet people.
I do vet people. Well, the first test
and you've
I do
expelled
is,
people.
I have. Oh, I actually have expelled people who are trying to promote a song or trying to promote. You know, I don't mind, and I think people finally have gotten the message on this.
Right.
I don't mind promoting a local card for somebody. Like, for example, Jesse Hernandez was part of California, was part of the Olympic Auditorium. I don't mind doing that. I don't mind doing stuff like that. But there's a good portion of the guys who don't go to shows anymore.
Right.
As we talked about in other shows, they feel wrestling has kind of left them behind, and it's not that, you know, they don't want to support them. They just not interested.
Right.
And I feel like it's, you know, if you're just kind of roboing all those ads out, there's a lot better groups that you can go to where you can get the word out. And and especially if you join, I had this one problem with this one habitual repeater who kept promoting cards in New Zealand, and we had no members in New Zealand. I tried to explain to him that, you know, it doesn't do you a lot of good.
Right.
You know, it's kind of a wasted, you know. But I do want to keep somewhat the quote purity of it.
The California Classic Wrestling Group on Facebook, as Indiana Jones would say, it belongs in a museum. It is a history book, a living history book of this great and often overlooked California wrestling tradition here.
Right.
And that's what I love what you do, and I love having the California Classic Wrestling Podcast here on the Wrestling Viewpoint Network. And Dan, we're going to be talking today about the California Classic Battle Royal.
Right.
Which has a rich history, and is we in Millennium Pro Wrestling had our little ode to it, which I was honored to be a part of when we threw some out there. But we're going to delve into the real history of it and the highlights and the memories. And to help us along the way, I'll let you introduce our special guest in the lounge today.
Well, we have a gentleman who's a longtime wrestling fan, a broadcaster himself, mm-hmm. and he is the legendary brother of the legendary No Mercy Man himself. It's great to have Ryan Doyle here today.
Ryan Doyle, I wish I had a studio audience to greet you.
Oh, you know what? It's a pleasure to be. I like the lounge.
You like the
very
lounge?
Very comfy.
Yeah?
Yeah,
it's good. It's good, man. I'm waiting for Paul Roma to show up here. And all that stuff.
He's parking cars right now. That's the reason why you can't be here.
So now, Ryan, you are a member of the California Classic Wrestling group on Facebook, right?
Absolutely, I am. I love going on it. It's just, it brings back so much many memories, and I am so grateful. I've told you this, Dan. I'm so grateful that you were able to go ahead and make this group, because it is just so much fun to go on there and go down memory lane. It's a very special place and special times.
Well, thanks. I mean, the whole idea, part of it, the problem to me all the time was that it always seemed that California wrestling, northern and southern, got the short end of the stick on that stuff. And there was, and every time somebody passes away, it takes a little piece of the history with them, and it just bothered me in that inner retentive sense that I have, that I felt like this history was going away, and I didn't want to see it go away. And if by putting the group together, I've been able to salvage some of the Southern California, Northern California wrestling history, then I'm very happy about that.
But by making this group, though, for me, it makes me feel like I'm coming home when I go on there. It's really a special
I get that
thing.
A lot. That's nice. Thank you.
Yeah. You have a lot of memories of California Classic wrestling, right?
Oh, so many memories that are just cherished memories of me and my three brothers just going over there weekly. It was a second home, and enjoying the Battle Royal once a year was just a special thing that was. It was just so anticipated at our home.
Yeah, and that's funny, Ken, because we talked about on another show we did about what we love about wrestling. And one of the things we didn't bring up was really fun was when you had territories and you had these smaller groups that they were doing wrestling every week.
Right.
And instead of watching it on TV every Monday night or every Thursday night, you would actually go. To me, I would go to the San Bernardino Arena on Sunday nights at 7 o'clock. That was always the deal. And there was something, it was part of your routine. It was part of your life. It was like going to the movies or going to the store. And that's something that's missing now, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's great to go to these big shows inside the Staples Center and these large auditoriums and all this stuff. But there was something a lot of fun about just once a week going to the local arena and seeing shows.
I'm sure making lifelong friends and connections and memories with that.
And the same people, crazy and not crazy, were there every week. you would put together nicknames for them, whatever.
Sounds like you went to Ebbets Field, the way you described it.
Well, in the old days, that's a lot what wrestling was like.
Yeah.
It was like going to Ebbets Field going to any place, any of the stadiums, and you saw all the regulars. You knew. Yeah. I mean, I would always know, I could sit there, and in San Bernardino, there was always the blonde teenage girl and her older father, and when the blonde girl would get upset, she would start screaming so loud that all dogs in the area would start coming. She was just like a high pitch like that. And there was two security guards there, one Hispanic and one Anglo, and they were there, and they were I saw them on more than one occasion grab a guy and drag him out around the head and drag him up the aisle, and that guy would be back next week talking to them like nothing had ever happened, because it was just part of being family.
It was just part of it, huh? Is that blonde girl part of the Facebook group? Have you tracked her down yet?
No, I haven't tracked her down. I think but there's every time I go to a wrestling show, it's funny, I can look at the crowd and go, I know every single one of these types. I don't know them, who they are, but I know every single one of these types.
An archetype there. So let's dive right in and talk about this California Classic Battle Royal. So guys, for most part, I'm going to be sitting here in this. It's kind of an informal discussion. We got some points to get to, but I'm just going to be taking in a lot of this history. You guys have lived it and known it, and I'm learning myself here. I'm certainly aware of it, but there's so much I don't know, and I'm excited to hear. So, Dan, let's start with the history of it. How it started.
Well, you have the whole Battle Royal concept, which goes back, I think we've done before, to San Francisco. I think San Francisco was the first place that did a Battle Royal a long time ago. And it's something where, a Battle Royal is pretty commonplace these days. And in fact, to the point where it can get a little too commonplace. I mean, we've all seen some really bad Battle Royals in our time. Where guys are just going through the motions, and it's just, it becomes one more thing they have to do. One of my favorite stories about a Battle Royal, actually, Dusty Wolf, the longtime enhancement guy, wrote a great book about professional wrestling, and he talked about a Battle Royal that he was involved in down in Texas or right over the border in Mexico, where the ring was outside in the back of a bar, And the guys were getting dressed, and the promoter said, no, we have to do a battle royal. And they were like, oh, God. So they went out and got into the battle, and nobody wanted to do anything. It was just all that hanging on the rope stuff.
Yeah.
And Dusty Wolf came out, and there was a goat at ringside. And he picked up the goat and threw the goat into the ring. And the goat, everybody jumped out of the ring, and then Dusty Wolf said, there's the winner of your battle royal. Now can we go home? And, you know, you hear stories about that kind of stuff all the time. And I remember one time working on a show with the battle royal where the promoter forgot to tell who was going to win. Mm. So you had all these guys, and I always hate to do the indie riffic thing, but you know that they get very, very much. It means a lot to them.
Yeah.
Nobody was going out. They were all there, and the guy turned to me and goes, they all want to win this battle royal, and this is going to go on forever. And I said, all right, grab three big guys and have them run in and start throwing guys out. That's all you can do. You know.
Right. Right.
So I mean, those are the kind of things that happen. But the battle royal in Southern and Northern California is such a rich tradition. And Jim Cornette talked about this on a recent podcast, that the Royal Rumble really comes out of that tradition. It's held in January,
right?
Much like in California, the classic battle royals were always in January. It was something that you built to. And for Southern California, you really have to give Jeff Walton the credit for this, because this thing was laid out meticulously. They would start in June, or even a little before that sometimes, with little blurbs in the program. Battle Royals coming, here's the date. They would give you the date 6 months in advance.
Right.
And they would say, it's coming. So-and-so is now going to be in the Battle Royals. So-and-so is going to be the Battle Royals. And sometimes there are people who never made the Battle Royal, but they would say that they're going to be there. And the whole idea of it was that, depending upon the purse each year, they would wind up putting up X amount of money, supposedly, to join the battle royal, and the winner would receive that money. Sometimes it was $20,000, sometimes it was a little less than that, and they always awarded the big check, which was always the big cardboard check in the middle of the ring.
Right.
And I often wondered how many people went to the bank and tried to cash that check. But the thing about then they would do these little blurbs in the program, were like, Haystacks Calhoun would go, neighbor, that can buy that $20,000 will buy me a whole lot of taters, you know. and then there always would be somebody who didn't get in time. There was somebody who had no chance. I mean, it would be like a Noki or somebody, and there would be a blurb in a program like saying, you know, Antonio Inoki is mad because he didn't get here in time to get his entrance fee in the battle royal, you know. And so, I mean, they built this thing up, and the
storylines would have been different if they had PayPal.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But it was a big thing. It was a very exciting thing, because also a lot of guys would come in for the battle royal. A lot of guys on their way to Japan or Australia or back again, or just brought in for the battle royal. So you knew that the weeks leading up to the battle royal on TV was going to be packed. You were going to see guys from Northern California, from out of state, who were going to be there for the battle royal. And it was kind of like a WrestleMania moment. It was a legitimate excitement that you would have.
It was a can't miss event for you and your brothers,
Ryan. It was WrestleMania, obviously, before WrestleMania. And it was great because you spend all these months, you know, and you're following the local angle there, and you're watching these guys every single week, and you got your favorites and you got the ones you don't like. But then when the anticipation starts the battle royal, and you suddenly have the wrestlers who are in the wrestling magazines, and you see that they're coming in, it brought such an excitement. I mean,
you just didn't have a chance to see those guys. You didn't turn on YouTube and watch clips, right?
Exactly.
So it was a totally different fit.
Exactly. You just had inside wrestling and the wrestler as your, you know, things you lived off of to find out about what happened everywhere else. But then when you'd find these names in the Olympic Auditorium program, it just blew your mind.
Right.
And it was such a great build to that it was just an absolute cannot miss event at our house. And my brothers and I would just be so excited that you know, forget Christmas. We were talking about 2 weeks later when the Battle Royal was
happening.
And, you know,
that's also a wise thing because a lot of people gave Battle Royal tickets as Christmas gifts.
Yeah.
So it was a nice way. Yeah. Yeah, see, there was a thing called pre-sale that people oftentimes don't think of these days, that they would buy these tickets in advance. And it was a big, big moment. And it was something that even, like you said before, even if guys weren't going to be there, they would start dropping names.
They would.
Oh, Bruno Sammartino is going to be there. Oh, you know, so-and-so is going to be there. Knowing that, you know, it was just floating things out.
Right.
But it was a very exciting time to be a wrestling fan. It really was.
And it was great because... You know, before the Raul Mata versus, you know, whoever he would be wrestling, Jimmy Lennon would have the microphone and say, coming soon to the auditorium, it will be Pedro Morales, you know, and he would say mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. And you would just be like, whoa, wow, really? You know, and then sometimes, unfortunately, the wrestler wouldn't make it.
Yeah, they wouldn't make it or would show up briefly, and then the payoff wasn't really good, and then they were gone again.
Exactly.
But that was something. Yeah, that was something that was very exciting. And those mm-hmm. cards, those mm-hmm. cards, Battle Royal and I were stacked.
Oh yeah.
I mm-hmm. mean, you would have title matches, and the whole idea of the Battle Royal was to, in many cases, it was the end. It was like the end of a season, beginning of a season. Absolutely. It was the end of feuds, but also they would start a lot of feuds that would go on for the next 6 months.
That came out of the
matches there. And you would have some amazing matches that you would, were almost like dream matches then.
Gotcha. So it's I'll give the example of, we look at modern times now where WrestleMania is the reset button of the season, so to speak. So this is... Was that's fair to say that this is the point then for the book to flip?
All roads led to the Battle Royal.
Outstanding. When did the first one really kind of form up to be the California Classic Battle Royal?
Well, the very first Battle Royal was in 1970.
Okay.
And the winner of that was Rocky Johnson, the Rock's dad. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, the Rock was in the Rocks, force of habit. Rocky was in the ring with the Oregon Lumberjack. Now, the thing with that was, the Oregon Lumberjack was
he was not a world beater.
No, he was a TV guy, and the whole idea, and he was actually one of the Romero family. He was the brother of another jobber named El Negro, and he was also the third brother, though, was Ricky Romero, who had quite a career in Texas and all over the place, and was the father of the Youngbloods. Jay Youngblood or the new they were called Southern Breed at one point or whatever, but that was that whole family there. But the whole idea was they wanted the Oregon Lumberjack to be the last guy in the ring with Rock, so that way they could show that anybody could win it. That was the whole thing. And the rules for the Battle Royal was a little different than what people are used to now. You do go over the top rope down there, but also they would allow pinfalls. So if two guys would force somebody down and lay on top of each other, they would pin somebody. And that was always good if you had an Andre the Giant or a Man Mountain Mike who was 600 pounds or a Haystacks Calhoun. That way somebody would always wind up doing the... doing the schoolboy, you know, and then would pile up on top of them. And Mil Máscaras always found a way to be the last guy on top.
He was always the one that would be on top. And then the most, for me, the most incredible thing about the pile up was that Red Shoes Dugan, the referee, would somehow launch himself over the pile up to do the three count. He was like the exclamation point to the pile up.
And then what they would do also, just to give you the idea of how dangerous. I mean, sometimes you lose that nowadays, that the Battle Royal was dangerous because you know, you have guys all around, you know, and I know that Tex Tunney was in a Battle Royal one time.
Tex was in a Battle Royal, that's right.
It's a little
he was forced in there by that scandalous Dan
Farron. That's right. And I know, you know, I know when we first talked about it, there was a little hesitance on your part because there was flailing fists all around you, and you have no idea what's going on. Right. And so if they had the situation, some guy usually got carried out. Somebody got carried out.
Yeah.
And it wasn't unusual to see blood in a battle royal at that point. Yeah, it wasn't unusual at all. So they would do that quite often. So there was those little set pieces, much in the same way as we, as I started to allude to before, Pat Patterson, who spent a lot of time in Northern California and sometime down here for the Battle Royals there, when the time came to create the Royal Rumble, he had a master class in Battle Royals because of all the work out here. And that's why there's no, it's not a happy happenstance that the Royal Rumble is held in January.
Right.
I think to most people who are old time wrestling fans, January means Battle Royal.
Battle Royal.
You know? So that was the very first one. And here's the nice thing about it also is the history of you know, it wasn't like they would forget what happened 2 or 3 years ago in many cases. The history would hold over. So like when 1971, when they had the second Battle Royal, the whole idea was, in a way, Rocky was the defending champion of the Battle Royal. So what they did was he got down to the very end again, and it looked like, was he going to repeat? But they gave it to a guy, an old hand, a guy who'd been around and would still be around in many different guises, a guy called the Professional, the Mass Professional. And he hurled either salt or some sort of powder in Rocky's eyes and won the Battle Royal. The whole idea behind that was, again, here was a guy who was a mask guy who worked mostly in Atlanta down there. And the whole idea was to give him a push. He won the Battle Royal at Blessing. He did it on in evil ways.
Nefarious
means. I don't think, actually, I think the pro only hung around for another month or so after that. I think he was gone. It didn't work out as one of those things happened. But, Doug Gilbert, and that's not the same Doug Gilbert that a lot of people know, Eddie Gilbert's younger brother. This was a guy who actually passed away last year. And again, that's another thing where you see that and you go, oh, there's so much history there. I'd like to have talked to him about it. But he wrestled as Gas House Gilbert in the WWF later on. And I think he filled in under a mask a lot of times. But again, this was a way of creating somebody, as they talk about now with Battle Royals, much in the way they try to do with Roman Reigns.
And the 2014 Royal Rumble.
Yeah.
And they've done that before. They did so well, I think, with Diesel in 1994. So that's, you can see the power of using these big rumbles to really kind of build stories. I see it. So we're up to 71, and we're not going to go year by year,
but
it an immediate thing in 1970 that the crowds just suddenly were like, oh, this is,
well,
this is great?
Well, the thing was that the crowds were big
generally
anyway.
Generally big every week.
It was a golden time. Right after probably Blassie and Tolles, when they stumbled a little bit and they lost the audience, or the audience just moved on. All through the 60s, when they were still the WWA, the crowds were always big and always popped, and the roster was so deep with all these guys.
That second tier was always had a lot of people.
Second
up there.
Tier, yeah, always did. And what they did in 1972 is kind of interesting, because they took a chance. They brought Bruno Sammartino in, and Bruno won the Battle Royal. And now, Bruno had never really wrestled in Los Angeles. I mean, he was a legend. He was a name. And they thought, well, let's try bringing him in and see if that pops the crowd a little bit, because he's never been here before. They know his name from magazines. There was no way from the 1960s through the early 70s that if you were a wrestling fan, you didn't know who Bruno Sammartino is. And actually, Bruno was at the point where, kind of like Hulk Hogan would later and Steve Austin would, he was well known outside fans. People knew who he was.
Seeped into the pop culture as it is.
And they brought him in, and he won the Battle Royal, and he stayed and wrestled for a while against guys like Killer Kowalski, his old enemy here, but it didn't really work out. Bruno has been quite vocal that he didn't particularly like the way Mike LaBelle ran the Southern California promotion. And Mike was very much vehement. If the match didn't draw the money that he wanted, he wasn't going to artistically bring it back, even if it left an open end. And that's, yeah, exactly. So, you know, even if it...
Story's unfinished.
Exactly. To him, the bottom line was it didn't draw money. You know, and I think the story that Bruno tells is that he and Kowalski had a match, and he went to LaBelle, let's bring the match back next month. And he says, no, I'm going to have you wrestle the Sheik next month, because we didn't make any money, so we're going to move on. And that's when Bruno said, doggone it, I think this guy's an idiot, and I'm out of here.
Back up. Let's Ryan, let me ask you. Let's jump a little bit to your first memory of seeing a California Classic, and then we'll fill in some.
Well,
more time
I went to the Battle Royal back when Toru Tanaka, Professor Toru Tanaka, won the Battle Royal, and I was 5 years old, but I do remember very clearly the matches, the Battle Royal itself. But the two memories that really stick out for me, the first one is the fact that I remember my mother drove us to that show and just sat out in that Olympic Auditorium parking lot the entire time in her car waiting for us to finish.
That was the bravest person the entire evening that sat in the parking lot over on Grand Street there.
She sat in that parking lot the entire time.
Right.
And the other great memory I have is of just turning and looking at my brother Scott, who's 2 years older than me, and him just puking. He just threw up all over the aisle there.
Doyle family memories for sure.
Wow. I mean, you know, we just put that in
during frame. What match was that? Is that a
I think
a
that
little,
was in the middle of the Battle Royal.
Oh, that's nice.
Wow.
Just in the middle. And then those poor guys in the caps and the jackets had to come down and mop it up.
Well,
right?
All I know is I remember just screaming that we're not leaving. We're not leaving.
Was it the excitement of the Battle Royal that got them worked up? Or?
I think it was more of that wonderful Olympic Auditorium food. I think he may have had one too many hot dogs and the ice cream with the stick in there or something. I think it was, but still, even so, great times.
So what year was that, Dan, by your record book that he went?
Tanaka would be 1977.
Wow.
Does that sound about right?
So I was six, yeah.
So did they all stop in the middle of the ring and get mad because you were upstaging them and say, we're not going anywhere until somebody cleans up that puke?
No, but I'm sure the people sitting by us didn't appreciate the smell.
Yeah.
Right. But they wait
all year long for the Battle Royal and some kid throws up next to them. That's perfect, you know.
Oh.
So by that time, 77, Dan, I've got to imagine this is the event, right?
Yeah, it is the event. Unfortunately, that's also about the time that they started having trouble keeping a really deep roster. And as you can see by looking at the winners of some of the later Battle Royals, it just wasn't quite prestigious as it was. One of the things that really helped was the sudden advent of the popularity of Andre the Giant. Andre the Giant was the king of the Battle Royal.
Yeah.
And he won two of the Battle Royals. He won in 1975 and he won in 1980. Though the 75 one was a really good Battle Royal. And I've been able to piece a lot of that together. Well, there's two things that are very interesting about that. This is, and Kurt Brown and I talk about this all the time. And we often hope that somebody has this in a garage someplace. But that show, at least that one, was videotaped with no commentary. And I came home from San Bernardino Arena one Sunday night and flicked on my little black and white TV set in my room and was, you know, clicking through the dials, which you had to do back
then.
And all of a sudden, there's wrestling from the Olympic Auditorium. And it's 6 months later, and I recognize this as being the Battle Royal card, because back then, when you were a kid, you remember every match.
Yeah, every
And they videotaped and ran the Battle Royal and showed it filling in on Channel 34, the Spanish language station, somewhere between like a movie and, you know, Sábado Gigante or whatever. Yeah. But, you know, somewhere in between there, and they had it. And I sat there like, oh, my God. And that has been one of the things like that. And the Blasi Tolos match at the Coliseum is like the holy grail. If somebody could find this. Though my feeling is that someone cut it up and made ukulele picks out of it. Unfortunately, that's how it usually happens. But that was a great Battle Royal. Because
this is the 75 one,
you had Pat Patterson and Moondog Maine came down from Northern California. And we've seen the picture. In fact, I used it for one of the early bumpers of the California Classic, where Andre would pick up Pat Patterson over his head and then toss him out. I know a lot of fans. When I printed the results recently of the anniversary of the show, some Northern California fans were, Dennis Stamp beat Moondog Maine in a match? And I said, well, yeah, because Stamp was the TV champ.
Right.
And they were down for one night. And then that was basically about it. And Patterson that night actually wound up wrestling Eduardo Carpante, which I imagine was a great match for the America's title. And here's an angle they did. Black Gorman had come back for one night only, for the Battle Royal. He went down, challenged Carpentier or Patterson, whoever was going to win the match, to defend the title to them. After the match was over, and Patterson had lost, Gorman jumped in, and Gorman and Patterson beat up a Carpentier, injuring his hand, re-injuring his hand, and he couldn't wrestle in the Battle Royal that night. So that became, there's one angle for the next couple of cards. All and right. that match went, that match and the rematch went a good month and a half after that. But you had a lot of really great hands in there. And the fans, because they knew the history among wrestlers, like Victor Rivera and John Tolles, when they would get down to those guys, they would get very, very excited. But this Battle Royal in 75 was the first one that Andre won. And at some point, I think it was Tolles and Greg Valentine bloodied him with a pair of handcuffs. So you had Andre, and now, you know, Andre was getting down toward the end of the match, but he was bleeding. So, you know, he couldn't see. He was staggering around the ring because Andre was much more mobile at that time. And he could really, really sell. And they had been building up the Mighty Zulu, who was a
mistake.
Mistake, yeah. Was a very muscular, kind of like the Ultimate Warrior Hulk Hogan before its time. And we could do an entire show just on the Mighty Zulu. But for whatever it was, they brought him into the area. He had been mostly working tag team matches with SD Jones and Porkchop Cash. But they brought him into the area, and the idea was, because he had this full Nelson that nobody could break out of, they wanted to get down to Andre and Zulu is the last two guys in the ring. So they the guys get tossed down. Well, one little funny thing was the handcuffs, for whatever reason, Black Gorman decided to handcuff himself to Man Mountain Mike, who was over 600 pounds. So that way, figuring that no one could throw both of them out that way. But Zulu, because he was very strong, tossed out Mike, and poor Gorman went flying out after him because they were attached. But that's so funny. Now you had Zulu and Andre in the ring, and Andre's bloody and he's staggering around, and Zulu clamps on the full Nelson. And Andre like drops to one knee, and he's battling, and he breaks out of it. No one's done that yet. Zulu's amazed by this, so he goes for another full Nelson. He cinches that thing in, and Andre breaks out again. And I think he went for like a shoulder block or whatever. Andre knocked him down, gave him the old headbutt and the big splash, and pinned him. And they did a couple matches. I'll see if you remember this, Ryan, but it seems to me that they turned Zulu heel, but it wasn't very well done.
Well, there was only so much you can do. With
Them. Exactly. And they had a match or two after that, and then Zulu was gone within a month or two. But that was a great battle royal, and it had all the components that you needed, and it set up matches. And like, for example, Greg Valentine and Tolles would throw out Pampero Firpo. Well, Pampero Firpo and Greg Valentine would eventually have a series of matches, which led to a loser leave town match. So everything was laid out like chess work, and this is something we would need to talk to Jeff about or Scott sometime to see how far out they planned. But they would plan at least 6-7 months. I think Jeff said at one point they would plan after Battle Royal through the middle of summer, and then the middle of summer start planning going toward the Battle Royal. Because one of the things they used to do, if you remember this, Ryan, was when we got close to the Battle Royal, like the last card in December, sometimes they would do an entire show of loser leave town matches.
I do remember that.
They would clean out some of the guys that they wanted to move on, so they had room to bring the new guys in. So, I mean, and the build up to Zulu also was they did something very rare, because they rarely, if ever, did a Battle Royal. I can't remember them ever doing it after they started doing the yearly Battle Royal. But I know on one time on KCOP they did do a little mini Battle Royal where they put Zulu over right before that, about 3 weeks beforehand, so that way to get the idea, okay, this guy is dangerous, he's in a Battle Royal, he can win that.
And Andre won in 75 and 80, and Ryan, you were there?
I was there in 1980, and it was not only, in my opinion, the best Battle Royal I saw, it was perhaps the best undercard I saw. The undercard was just sensational. They had the Funk Brothers, and they wrestled the Twin Devils for the tag team titles, which was a great match back then.
Oh, and here's a trivia thing. actually four guys who actually were brothers. They were billed as brothers.
And they, and they actually were brothers. They actually were.
A wrestling rarity.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the Funks actually got the belts that night.
I think they did. I'm not quite sure, but I'm pretty sure they did.
Yeah, and they had... Andre was wrestling Victor Rivera, and I remember that match. It was a fun match to watch. And they also have brought back the what was at the time the major feud in Southern California, but it went away for about maybe 6 months to a year, and they brought it back that night, which was the local favorite, Chavo Guerrero, against the most hated wrestler in the area, who went to Portland and came back that night, which was Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Nice.
And they brought that, and they had been feuding from about, I would say, like from 76 through, I mean, literally through early 79 or so, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, they would bring that match back from time to time. They would fly Piper in from wherever he was.
Right.
Yeah. So Piper was booked in Portland at the time, and they brought him back for the Battle Royal, and there was almost as much anticipation for that one match than there was for the Battle Royal. And it was great because Piper came out, and he came out with the bagpipe playing and everything. And people hadn't seen him for quite a long time. And Chavo just tears out of the locker room and starts chasing him around the ring. And they're running around, and everybody's just in a frenzy because they've been waiting for so long for one more match with them. And it was just, it was an awesome, awesome thing. So that match was great. And the
That says a lot about Heat, which doesn't exist anymore, that he had been gone for several years.
Yeah, right.
The
yeah.
fans hated him, and he hadn't even been there for
Piper's
3 or 4 years.
Heyday in L.A. was, what, 74?
75, 76 in
so
that area.
So you're talking at least 4 years gone, and then bring him in back.
And although the territory was in decline at that time in the 70s, that feud was what really carried the territory, to the extent is that Chavo and Piper had every imaginable type of match that you can have two people wrestling. Everything from chain matches to Mexican death matches to Texas death matches, like there's a difference there, every type of strap matches, everything, lumberjack matches.
Yeah, they belts, loser leave town matches. They did the famous thing where Piper came back as the Canadian. At one point, yeah. It was one of those things like with Tolis and Blassie, where you could plug in any type of stip, and it would always draw, and that says a lot for the feud, and says a lot for Piper and Guerrero that they could, after 3-4 years, bring that match back, and people remembered it, and in fact they were anticipating it, like you said.
Right, and the Battle Royal match itself, like I said, was probably the greatest I had ever seen. There was, in my opinion, there was just so much wrestling star power in there, and locally and out of the territory, and when it got down to the final three participants, which were Andre and the Funk Brothers. And Andre had done this type of thing in different territories where you usually get two or three guys and winds up kind of doing the series of things. But, the Funks are double teaming him and beating the tar out of him. And you're thinking, well, these guys are going to go ahead and finally dump him over, which you never saw Andre thrown over the top. But Andre would smash them together and give the big boot to Terry, and Terry went Dory, and Dory went flying over the top, and then it wound up for a few seconds just being Andre and Terry, and then he threw Terry over, and the crowd was so so into it. And like I was saying, the territory at the time was a little in decline, so you didn't go to a lot of shows throughout the year where the second tier had people in it. It was literally kind of the bottom tier was full. That night, both tiers filled.
Yeah. Can you describe for me a scene, Andre, in action? How does that look to a young boy?
He was so much larger than life. The wrestlers at the time, particularly in the Battle Royals, they would come one at a time and down the aisle. And the aisle was sort of situated in the middle there. And Jimmy Lynn would read off each person, right when they're getting ready to hit the ring. And after seeing 19 guys, big guys, good shape guys, different sizes, you would see the equivalent of a tractor trailer start coming down this aisle.
Right.
And I was, in my eyes, just thinking, wow, I have never mm-hmm. seen anything like this human being.
Yeah.
Unreal. And dwarfing all the crowd that's surrounding him, because it wasn't like it is today. We had the big barricade and sure. all that. He was pretty much kind of going through the crowd. And it was the big hair and the yeah. giant wide body. It was so unbelievable to see. And when he got into that ring and stepped over the top rope, it was just a thing that you couldn't wrap your head around, yeah. even though you were looking at it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was amazing, because I know they used to, what they do is they was, because the Battle Royal was so popular at the Olympic at the same time, around the Horn in Bakersfield and San Bernardino and Ventura, mm-hmm. they would have their own Battle Royals.
Okay.
Not as big, and you know, just with maybe about 12 guys or whatever. But I remember the same year that Andre won, he won the Battle Royal in San Bernardino too, eliminating Greg Valentine. And what I remember about that is the San Bernardino Arena the was originally created for boxing at a time when, and there was some wrestling too there, but at a time when there wasn't a lot of flying out of the ring and stuff. So literally, when you sat in the San Bernardino Arena, you were maybe 4 feet from, the front row was 4 feet from the ring apron. I mean, wow. It was just like right there. And I remember when the heels were trying to dump Andre out, that entire first row ran for their lives. Because, I mean, the way you described it, it's not a visual thing, but I would say, if you took a look at Andre, if you got up close to him, and we know there's been some question about, was he really 7'4"? He's a little bit shorter than that. But from a width standpoint,
yeah.
he was literally, it appeared to be 5 feet in length. Yeah. I mean, he just seemed massive. That way. He was massive. Mm. And this was the time, and you can find this in older clips. I mean, he had started to slow down just a touch, but he was still doing, he would go off his feet. He would do splashes. And if you go back to the time when he was in Canada first starting out, when he was Jean Ferrer, he would do like flying body presses off the top rope and drop
kicks. Right. I've seen some still photos of that.
And that's absolutely amazing. Yeah. The first time I saw Andre the Giant, I walked in the San Bernardino Arena. He was in his street clothes. He was getting coffee. And just to give you an idea, he had a coffee cup. He was taking it back to the locker room for the boys. He had a styrofoam cup between each fingers in his hands.
Wow.
And yeah. that's how he was carrying them back.
So you saw that in person. So
I saw that in
those
person.
Those tales are true.
Those tales
I
are
love
true.
That. I love that.
I have another interesting Andre story in that, you know, in the mid-70s, probably when I was about 6 or 7 years old, my brother and I saw Andre sitting by the concession stand at the Olympic Auditorium. So we just said, you know, all four of us kind of converged and said, okay, do we go over there? You know, or will we be killed or what?
Or eaten.
And, yeah. And we made our way during the intermission up there, and he was sitting there, and it was kind of like he was on display. There was sort of like this little ring of people just like staring at him. Yeah. And, you know, go figure that he would be so grumpy about people down the road. They're just staring at him. And my brother and I went up and we actually got Andre's autograph on one of the programs.
Wow. Oh, wow.
And we shook his hand. And his hand...
Or attempted to, right?
Well, attempted to. His hand, like, took... I just remember just like, took from my fingers to my elbow almost. It was just... Yeah. Unreal.
Wow.
and it was intimidating, but it was, I'm glad we did that. And
do you still have that autograph?
I think my mom threw that away. She threw everything away
along with a Mickey Mantle rookie card.
She didn't care. She was mean about throwing things away.
She's waiting in the parking lot the entire
time. Right. She's still mad at you. You got to give her that if you're gonna do.
No idea what she was throwing away.
Exactly.
So this is 80 dead. Let's talk a little bit. You mentioned it, Ryan. I want to talk a little bit about the promotion of it and how they rolled that out 6 months in advance. You gave a lot of credit
before
to Jeff
you do
Walton
that,
about that. Yeah.
Before you do that, I do want to hit one thing. They made what Ryan and I have talked about before is, we think, a serious error around 75, 76.
Gotcha.
They decided, because, again, the audience was starting to fall off a little bit. Guerrero and Piper had really probably saved that territory for two, 3 years just from that.
Right.
But they decided, well, we did really well in January. Let's do another Battle Royal, the Summer Battle Royal.
Oh, wow.
And by doing that, they diluted it. And yeah. and plus also, they didn't have a strong enough roster at that point. So that's why when you started getting down to it, and no offense to some of these guys, but like Leroy Brown and the Twin Devil and Professor Tanaka and Hector Guerrero, who won some of the later ones.
Well, Mondo Guerrero,
Mondo won the last one. Mondo won the very last one. No offense to them at all, but they weren't gigantic stars. And in the case of the Guerreros, they were already over. So, it was a nice thing to do, but in many cases, it didn't really pop the audience. And I think that when they did the secondary battle royal, it really hurt. And then at one point also, they had worked out some sort of deal with the WWF at that point, and they were sending Bob Backlund,
right,
who won one of the battle royals, out to Los Angeles. And I think the first year they did it, it was okay, because that was the year in 1976 where Java Rook won. And we talked about Java Rook before. He was Johnny Roz.
Yeah.
And he was supposed to get the big push. Now, as the legend always goes, if Johnny Roz had liked his payoffs and stayed around, Piper, I firmly believe that Roddy Piper would have eventually existed somehow. But it would have delayed it a little bit.
Right.
And Piper was his handler. And that same year, the Summer Battle Royal was won by Piper. But after that, it just, Victor Rivera won one, and he had won two, I think, actually, altogether. Right. But it started to dilute it at that point, and that really it didn't help at all. And I think they eventually went back to one battle royal.
They did go back to one.
Yeah,
they did.
So how long do they have the double? How long?
4 years,
three or four years. Oh, wow. Yeah.
It's a long run.
Yeah, but it just didn't spark that anticipation, sure, because there was just so much to be said for having to wait for that one.
Yeah.
Moment in January that, the Summer Battle Royal, even as a little kid, I remember thinking, oh, this is kind of weak.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking that,
And the fans felt the same way, because
the turnouts weren't the same.
No, if they had done that, maybe when they had the roster that they did, they could have. It might have. It'd be interesting to see. But when you were down to, and this was no fault of the promotion, you just didn't have the guys available. The guys were tied up places where the money was a little more solid, or it's just. And again, as we've talked about before, Los Angeles is real fickle when it comes to that. So there's so much going on here.
Yeah.
And they just started to lose their audience.
Mm. I mean, you're replacing names like Tolis and Victor Rivera, who had these established legacies in Southern California, for these Summer Battle Royals that had people like Bad News Allen Cowage and people that just didn't have the same spark. No, and as much as they tried, and as much as Mike LaBelle might have thought it was a good idea, ultimately the fans just weren't that into it. And it almost, in a way, sort of deadened a little bit to the excitement of the January one. It kind of took away from that.
Yeah, it would have to.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sorry, go back to your.
Yeah, well, just I'm trying to get into the fun and excitement of especially as a kid. But Dan, you watching it too, when the names would start rolling out.
Yeah,
they seem to do a very good job with that.
And they would actually put in the program. Here's a little thing. Rip this out and give it to the usher. There were ushers then. They wore little white caps and little jackets and ties, and they would say, "Who do you want to see in the battle royal?"
A little all-star vote there.
A little all-star vote, that kind of stuff. And they would build to it. And then if you look at any of the Battle Royal programs, there was always a page where they had all the numbers. We're filling, kids. You can fill in who won, who got eliminated in what order. And they did make it feel very, very special. And I remember, because I was in San Bernardino and couldn't go down for the Battle Royals. I couldn't wait till the show the next night to find out what happened. Mm-hmm. I would even go down and get the old Herald Examiner, which was the worst results in town. They were always either badly done, or the guy who got them was unhappy that it was his job in life to write the one paragraph out with the. So he would make all kinds of jokes, you would go through the paper, try to see what the who won the battle royal, and I remember actually the funny thing about it was some of the older fans will tell you that they used to even though it was dangerous to do, send the results to the newspaper in advance so they could be able to hit the deadlines at that point. And I'm sure there's probably a lot of results there that of the guys beating other guys that never happened because right. that's what it was.
That's, so. That's a funny little inside scoop on a little history there that's overlooked. So what were some of the other big winners, Dan, or memories? We got people who are writing to us with memories today, right, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, I also don't want to give any... Unfortunately, you know, our background is more Southern California, but yeah. there was a great Northern California. Again, Pat Patterson was involved quite a bit in those. Mm-hmm. Pat would come down for these battle royals, and I'm sure sometimes after working with Roy Shire, he was horrified by what he saw down here, just because it was a whole different approach. But and you had a lot of those guys would go up, you know, Tolis and, mm-hmm. and on a regular basis, though none of the guys were ever really put over as well up there as they were down here. No. That's just the way that was. But we had Ray Stevens, mm-hmm. you know, the amazing Ray Stevens. And I suggest to anyone who's not that familiar with him to go onto YouTube and to just watch as much as you can, because he doesn't get the credit for being as influential of a wrestler to a lot of the guys in the 70s. The Ric Flair and the Bobby Heenan flip in the corner comes from Ray Stevens. You know?
Right.
And he won several battle royals starting in 1979. No, I'm sorry, 1972. But you would normally have, you know, like, for example, here's an interesting match they would have. Their cards were really stacked also.
Yeah.
You had Haystacks Calhoun against superstar Billy Graham and Roger Kirby. Roger Kirby was a really solid hand, mostly worked the Central States, but he would come out here. But and then they would oftentimes use those shows to promote their guys and move guys up. Peter Maivia, won a couple of the battle royals up there. You had a tag team a handicap match, Andre the Giant against Pac Song and Kenji Shibuya. Wow. Which would have been a great match. And actually, the Battle Royal they had up there in 1974 had 15,622 people there and set a new record gate of over $64,000.
Wow. Hmm. Now that was at the Cow Palace.
That was at the Cow Palace at that point. And, you know, that's when, you know, the guys would go up. Because, again, they would run Saturday nights, where the Olympic always ran on Sunday, Friday night. Friday, so yes. You would have that. But Mr. Fuji won one of the Battle Royals up there. And Andre the Giant... in 1977 won the Battle Royal up there. So, I mean, he did add to himself as king of the Battle Royal. And then they even did, in 1978, they did a Harley Race NWA Championship match against Chavo Guerrero as part of the card. And that's the card where Don Morocco won the Battle Royal. Mm-hmm. And the one here that stands out to me that would be the most interesting is don't quite have the year here, but they actually had, I think it was probably had to be around 76 or later, because we talk about Java Root. Java Root did come back, which was ironic, as you know, after bailing in 76, he did come back later on
but didn't he come back as the unpredictable Johnny Rods at that point?
I don't know if he ever did that. The videos that I've seen on those collections or whatever have him as Java Root, so I don't know if he ever did it first there. But at one point Java Root wrestled Dory Funk Jr. in San Francisco, which would have been a very interesting. I would have been very interested to see what, because Johnny Ross was a solid wrestler. He really was. But when you're doing like the Arabian Wild Man, you know, you're using foreign objects, you're eye gouging, you're kicking with your little pointy boots,
right?
You know, that kind of stuff. As you well should.
As you should. So as the territory starts to cool down and come to a close, they decide in 82 to shut this down, or how does it come to an end?
Well, they decided to shut it down, but the main thing was they were having all kinds of problems. They were toward the last week of December in 82 in San Bernardino. Actually, the last show of the territory wasn't even at the Olympic. They did a show in San Bernardino right after Christmas.
Okay.
It was just, and again, that's something that I want to, when we start having some people on here who were there, I want to find out what it was like, what it felt like. I know from interviewing Jeff in the past, they knew it was coming, but it's that whole thing, and we all know it from working with independent groups. You know that it's over. You hope that maybe it won't be over, but eventually, either through losing venues or losing TV, loss of TV really crippled
right.
The Los Angeles promotion, and in general, it's very hard without TV. But I don't remember if that last year they were advertising a Battle Royal for the January. I don't
remember that.
That would be. I would like to go. I had to go through programs from '82 because I want to see if the writing was on the wall. If they went through just to go through the motions of advertising a 1983 Battle Royal.
I just never can imagine having George Mena on TV promoting a Battle Royal for that following year. I've never heard him do that. So
Mondo wins in '82 as the final winner, right?
That's the final winner.
Goes down in history as the final winner. Yeah. Did you see that one, Ryan? Did you see every year during a certain point?
I saw every single year, and I do remember seeing that, but I remember, again, very clearly being disappointed because I had seen these Battle Royals for years, being disappointed in the lack of star quality at that point.
Now, how old were you then?
I was 11.
Okay, so even at 11, you said this is not the Battle Royal that I was used to.
Yeah. Wow. This is really lacking compared to what I'm used to seeing, and being really disappointed in seeing that. I can't tell you right now. I could think off the top of my head perhaps a couple of people that were in it. I mean, obviously Mondo. Mm-hmm. I can remember possibly Bad Boy Bobby Lane was there, and there was a masked wrestler, masked luchador named Kiss, who was there, and it really boiled down to that, where at that point the promotion I don't think had what it took to bring any wrestlers from the wrestling magazine eras, which is what I call it.
And they did at one point, I mentioned earlier, try to work out something with the WWF where they would bring in some of the WWF guys, Tony Garea and guys like that. And then at one point they wound up going from the Olympic Auditorium to the sports arena, and
well, if you remember, Dan, there was almost when the WWF first sort of made their way to LA, there was almost this weird sort of flipping of the arenas. Like one month it would be at the Olympic, the next at the sports arena, the following month at the Olympic. And if I remember correctly, they actually had their one a battle royal of their own. The WWF,
I believe. I remember when the WWF first started came out to LA when they purchased the territories. Right. I mean, I have said to people, well, did they really purchase, or when Mike threw in the towel, did they just start running? Evidently, there was a deal.
From what I've heard, there were the Tunnies in Toronto, the Hearts in Calgary, and the LaBelles in LA were the only, and the Bosches, I believe, were the four territories that Vince actually paid for and didn't just run them out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because he had that much respect for those four.
Right. And plus, also, this was still, it would have been 1983 mm-hmm. at this point. And really and truly, I'm sure that McMahon was thinking about expansion at that point.
Yeah.
And I always looked at Los Angeles as being like the first shot fired, to some extent, because when Northern California went under the year before, Vern Gagne moved into San Francisco. So, I mean, all these guys were always looking at expansion, whether or not they want to, you can vilify Vince for that. It's just he was the only one that was successful at it.
Yeah.
They all would have tried it or would have done it if they possibly could. But they did a battle royal there in January of 1984. It had been like almost 2 years after that. And they billed it. I mean, they pumped the fact that it was a battle royal. And they mixed in some people like John Tolles and Irish Mickey Doyle and
Alexis Smirnoff.
I was going to say, the famous Alexis Smirnoff was in there.
And I believe Goliath.
Tony Rocco.
Yeah. And mixed that with the Iron Sheik and with the Tito Santanas. And
I think the thing that, while it, you had your WWF fans,
yeah,
who were there. I mean, and again, without them, they would not have drawn. But you also had your regulars, your Olympic regulars, who were going back for the first time, and they ran for a couple months after that, virtually every other week for a while. It was kind of weird. Yeah. They were doing a lot of shows.
Twice a month,
and then at that point, they kind of gave up the ghost. And I don't think by spring they were out.
And really interesting matches, because you'd have Mil Máscaras versus Ivan Koloff and people like that. So
when they were booking there, they put an eye toward who would draw. I mean, that's what the old school guys did. Mm-hmm. They knew who would pop the territory. And I believe Andre won that battle.
I was
going
to say, Andre did win that battle royal.
And and it made perfect sense to do that. But I remember that on the undercard, I remember Mickey Doyle and Tony Rocco doing a draw in the opener. Mm. But I remember that in most cases, the local guys were there to job for the WWF guys.
Right.
And I felt the big thing was the one match that I remember. We talked about watching the crowd turn on the Royal Rumble the other night.
Yeah.
Watching the crowd kind of turn at the Olympic was when Tony Greer, who was working as mostly an enhancement guy, he was ending his career anyway, but he wasn't really winning matches, big matches. He was losing most of the time on TV. Pinned John Tolles clean. And I remember feeling the rumbling through the crowd that this was not, they were not happy about that. But I mean, again, for the WWF, who at that time was like history be damned, looking at it and saying, this is something that has worked there before, let's try it again and see.
And I want to mention another person who was working at that particular time that we're talking about right now, was the Arizona Flash, Billy Anderson. I do remember he was almost their last, very last attempt at a local hero,
right?
To sort of take the place of a Chavo.
They put the Beat the Champ TV title on him. He was the last person to hold the Beat the Champ TV title. And we've talked about having Billy on the show, and we are going to definitely try to do that. That's one of the things that I wanted to talk to him and a couple of the other guys that are still around about those final months in LA. And did you see the bullet coming?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, we touched earlier about battle royals, how they can get dangerous.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but wasn't that very last battle royal that the WWF had actually done that night, didn't Billy Anderson wind up getting carried out or hurt battle royal?
I think he did.
Whether
or not it was actually or whatever, but the thing was, that was always, they loved to do the spot where, and sometimes what they would do is they would prove the battle royal was so dangerous, they would do a pile up where not just the big guy, like a Calhoun or a Mountain Mike or whatever, would do a thing. They would have just some normal guy get on the bottom of like 12 people. And then they would do this big thing. Maybe the guy would do a blood capsule in the mouth and look like he was spitting up blood or whatever. But they would do this whole big thing where they would bring the stretcher down to ringside and they would roll him out of the ring. And maybe the despicable heel would stomp on him once or twice or something, you know.
Right.
And then they would roll him up the aisle just to prove that it was so dangerous. You know? Now, did you ever see any of the battle royals, Ryan, where Andre was eliminated?
Well, to say that he was eliminated is kind of an interesting thing to say. I would say more, I saw the battle royals where Andre sort of got rid of himself. Now, I remember one very clearly, again, very late in the promotion. It might have actually been in 81, where Andre was in the battle royal and he was having a thing in the ring with Ox Baker. And he somehow, I guess, he eliminated Ox Baker, and he probably drunkenly somehow sort of managed to start running after him. And he went over the top rope, and of course, you know, everybody's just shocked. Oh, he just eliminated himself and went running after Ox Baker into the dressing room. But that was about the only way you were going to get rid of Andre was for Andre to kind of get rid of himself.
If he wanted to go.
Yeah, I mean, and that did now, did you find, did the audience, did the air go out of the audience a little bit? Were they disappointed to see Andre eliminated?
Big time. And to this day, my brother, he still quotes this to me because I screamed this out in a second of fury. I stood up and yelled as before this is happening, because I've seen this happen before, and I'm yelling at the top of my lungs, "No, Andre, no, don't fall for it." And I'm screaming this, and then finally about 60 seconds later he steps over the top rope, mm-hmm. and he's up, but I could see it happening a mile away, mm-hmm. and yeah,
so at age 11.
It was so disappointing.
What you should do as a wrestling fan at age 11, or even 40 or beyond. As we wrap up here, guys, I want to ask you to maybe share some quick memories of some of your favorite moments in the California Classic Battle Royal. Little moments, not giant things, but just little moments, things you took away from it, and why it's so vibrant and important in your memories.
Well, you know, for me, it was simply the fact that these wrestlers that I saw in the wrestling magazines were in live, living color in front of me. Mm-hmm. You grow up and all your, you know, my reading was, forget school books, it was the wrestling magazines. And when I would see these wrestlers come for the Battle Royal, it was magic. It was like magic happened in front of me. And, you know, just having the mix of the wrestlers you saw every single week with the wrestlers you read about every single day in the magazines, that mixture was one of the greatest memories. And you know, on a personal note, those times with my brothers were the most special times I've ever had with, you know, family wise. So the combinations made those Battle Royals just a thing that I will cherish forever.
And absolutely, that's something that is missing from wrestling now. It was a family thing to do. I mean, in many cases, you know, there were situations where your mom would drop you off in the parking lot.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of times you went with your family and you had generations, maybe grandfather, father, and children or whatever. Mm-hmm. You went there. And I remember, and you know this even just from your time going to wrestling matches, mm-hmm. it's most fun when you go with somebody, when you go with people, where you can sit there and you can comment, or you can have a good time, or you get really excited or whatever.
Yep.
And those were the great moments to me. One thing that was interesting about those Battle Royals was that it did, they you know, everything goes, it's all every man for himself, but they didn't push it that much. The heels mostly worked with faces. The faces mostly worked with heels. They would on occasion have a situation where, you know, where you would have a face versus a face or a heel versus a heel. But the moments that I remember, just general moments that I remember from those things, is one that usually with Andre, again, going back to Andre, he was always the last guy introduced. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, when Andre stepped over the rope, everybody would run after him and attack him one time. That was the traditional thing to do. And that was that very moment when the Battle Royal began was very exciting, because this was something you'd waited for. And, you know, it's like anything for any big, whether it's a wrestling match or a UFC match or, you know, the main event at WrestleMania or the beginning of the Royal Rumble, there's something very, you know, and it's like, it's here it is. It's here. You know, it's that, this is the moment.
It's finally here.
It's finally here. And I've been waiting for months for it. And, you know, again, you know, for 6 months, you're advertising a match that maybe runs 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and there was that excitement there. And there was always the fact that, that as much as we talk about, you know, spots that we know, there was something always very unpredictable about a Battle Royal.
Yeah.
And there was those moments, and this is what I think is what people love about the Royal Rumble is he's going out. No, he's not going out. Oh, no, what's he going to do? What's going to happen?
Right.
You know, because you don't know what's going to happen in those cases. And that's what makes a really well-done Battle Royal. And unfortunately, like we said today, they're diluted a lot. They're thrown in. You know, Patterson had the right idea with the Royal Rumble, and that's become their second biggest pay-per-view, and it's my favorite match. Actually, it's the one thing that I like to watch every year, because I find it, you know, fascinating to see how they're going to lay it out and how they're going to plan it. And
it's always something interesting.
And you know, the ones that seem to work the best, again, I hate to be an old school cheerleader, but I'm going to be, but Pat Patterson and Strongbow used to book those on different occasions, and they used that old school mentality.
Yeah.
And no offense to like whoever's booked the last couple ones, I don't see that. I don't see that same kind of excitement being built up. It's a series of spots and whatever, and that's fine. But if you look at the Royal Rumbles, the best one was the one, to me, is one the one where Flair won the title.
Yeah, that was the hands down.
That's hands down the best one. And if you watch that, you can watch that over and over again. And when we were first doing the California Classics, first thing I did was sat down and watch that one again.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree. And I'm sure Patterson had his influence all over that one.
They went banana, as Mick Foley would always know. They went banana over it.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for talking and sharing your history and thoughts and opinions on the California Classic Battle Royal, a staple in the California, Southern California, and Northern California scenes. Thank you so much for coming to the Wrestling Viewpoint Studios.
Thank you for having
Mr. Doyle.
Us. Thank you very much.
We're going to grab you and probably open up your brain and go into some of your Olympic auditorium memories, too, if you would allow us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
You can stay here in the lounge until our next show.
It's so comfy. I like it.
Now, Baby Doll's going to come out and bring you an iced tea. All right? It's going to be good. Don't worry about it. So that is this edition of the California Classic Wrestling Podcast. And don't forget to seek out and find Dan Farron for approval to join the California Classic Wrestling Facebook group. Dan, talk a little bit about that, about the Facebook group again.
Yeah, the group has been really wonderful because I know that personally with my life, I've been very busy recently and I haven't been able to do as much day-to-day stuff with it. But people step up, they always talk about. And we have some amazing people who are eyewitnesses to the history, who are scholars and people who are...
And people who are participants.
Participants, exactly, and relatives. I was very pleased recently to find out that in the mid '60s there was a wrestler named El Mongol, who was a staple here in Atlanta. He was Gorilla Monsoon's tag team partner out here, and his son is a member of the group and has been participating. And we've also started to get some roller derby people in there, which is kind of cool too. There's a bit of a crossover there, so I'm pleased that we have this informal oral history going on, and that we also have great historians who are writing pieces directly for it.
And what I
love is I'll hear from people who'll say that, you know, I'm really not interested in wrestling, but I can't wait every day to see what people are sharing. And I had somebody at the Wrestling Cares Car. Cares card come up to me and thank me and tell me how much they enjoyed it. And it, you know, it's a labor of love. It's not work at all. It's a labor of love.
It is your passion. So find that on the Facebook machine, the California Classic Wrestling Facebook group. And thanks for listening to the Wrestling Viewpoint Network presents the California Classic Wrestling Podcast. The Wrestling Viewpoint Network is not just one show. It's a series of shows covering the wild world of and wide world of professional wrestling, looking back, looking at current times, and looking ahead, and looking at everything, and celebrating, and sometimes lamenting, and moaning, and bemoaning what is gone and what goes on. But find us on iTunes. You can find us on Stitcher and Podomatic as well. But if you're on iTunes, make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any shows. And rate and review, that is key to the success of any podcast in this modern age. Rate and review and subscribe. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter at WrestlingVN. You can follow me on Twitter at Ken Knapsack. You can follow Dan Farron at Real Dan Farron. Ryan, you on Twitter?
Yes, I am.
Oh,
find
look at you.
At Ryan A. Doyle.
Ryan A. Doyle, and share some memories with him. Both of these gentlemen love talking California Classic Wrestling.
And if you've had a relative who's thrown up during a wrestling show, let Ryan know about it. So
we have a common bond.
Share that memory. So,
and also, I can say to everybody, keep passing the word around. That's how we've grown. Also, it's just I get a lot of people who've been recommended by friends or whatever, and I think it's that's the way to keep building. Also, is recommend us, keep circulating the tapes, as MST used to say.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Till next time, for Dan and Ryan, I'm Ken Knapsack here. For the Wrestling Viewpoint Network, we will see you next time.